Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We just do a quick sound check. So, if you want to say the best thing, the best Buddhist quote you know.
The first thing that popped into my mind was, and I don't even know if this is a real Buddhist quote, I think it might be a Zen saying,
okay.
But it's, the only wisdom you'll find at the top of the mountain is that which you take up there with you.
Nice.
It's good, isn't it?
That's annoyingly deep.
Yeah.
That reminds me of, who was it? A mate of mine went on holiday recently because he was really upset. He was like, I'm going to refine myself. And I was like, no, you're not. You're still going.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He got really annoyed by that.
Yeah, there's that book, isn't it, called Wherever You Go, There You Are.
Oh, I've not heard that one.
Yeah, I haven't read it. It's another book I haven't read. But it's a great title, isn't it?
I've got a book called Jeff the Buddha and Me. Have you read that?
I have read that, yeah, years ago.
I'm about halfway through it, yeah. It's good.
Yeah.
And it's not patronizing. I was thinking it would be.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's nice as a starting point for when I was getting into it.
Yeah, yeah, I read it when I first got into Buddhism.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 51. My name's Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, TV, and today, the touring circuit. Sam Brady is a comedian who, with no PR, TV profile, radio profile, management, or tour manager, managed to choreograph and put together his own national tour for his own show. This is part of our DIY series of comedians who have done something that you would ordinarily think you would need the industry, quote-unquote, to do, and have instead gone on and done it themselves. I found him really inspirational, I found him really interesting, and it was just generally one of those chats where it makes you wonder what you can and can't do without the industry, like whether you need to wait and ask for someone's permission to do something, or whether you can actually do it yourself. I'm always of the opinion that you can do it yourself, but it is also very helpful if you have someone backing you up. But we get into that, and we talk about why he did it, what he got out of it, what he's had to sacrifice to get it to the stage that it was at, and little hints and tips that have helped him along the way and that can obviously help you if you are thinking about doing the same thing. He's about to do the same thing and go on tour again with his new show, so if you would like to see details of that, you can look in the show notes. As always, if you could rate us in iTunes, that'd be amazing. It only takes about 30 seconds and it just really helps out the show. If you can't do that, just subscribe and you'll know when all the next episodes come into your inbox. I think this would be good for anyone who wants to put together their own tour, who has a show but isn't able to find themselves a touring manager or an agent to put that together for them, and wants to know how hard or tricky it is and which parts of that process are hard and can be made slightly easier by sharing information between us all. So I won't say much more because I pretty much ask every question in the pod that I would normally put into the intro. So without any more delays, this is Sam Brady.
So the reason I started doing my own tours was, well, I think it was because you have to sort of go back to the circuit. So, like, I started in comedy. I was 39 when I started, so I started late. And so I was 39 when I started. I started quite late, and I realised after a short while that there are all these gatekeepers on the circuit, promoters, and basically the game is you've got to keep going, largely for nothing or for very little money, putting in a lot of time, until these promoters decide that you're allowed to go to the next level. And that's kind of fine if you're 23. When you're 39, you start thinking, have I actually got time to impress this many people, you know? And I did it for a few years, and, you know, some people I got paid gigs straight away, and I was doing pretty well with. Some other promoters I did open spot after open spot, did well at them, never got any further. You know, some promoters I couldn't get a gig with at all. You know how it is. So I did that. I did start doing some weekend clubs, and I realised I hated them. Because basically if I wanted to babysit drunk teenagers, you know, I'd get a job in an inner city school. You know, I don't need it to be doing it at my weekends. And I just thought, well, there's a skill to doing these weekend clubs. But in the short time I've got in my career, do I want to spend time developing those skills, or do I want to spend time doing the stuff that I want to do? So sort of realizing, right, okay, I'm going to have to impress all these promoters so that I can do these weekend gigs that I don't want to do in order to eventually headline the nice gigs that I do want to do. And I'm 39. Well, in fact, I was older than that by then, 40 odd. And I'd done a show at Edinburgh. I went down. I'm never one for listening to advice. If people say to me, oh, you know, you can't do that, it's not just not done that way, I will do it, yeah. You know, and usually fall flat on my face, but, you know, occasionally not. So people said, oh, you can't do Edinburgh yet. You know, first you need to go down and do, like, you know, a few showcases, and then you can go down and do, like, you know, a two-hander or a three-hander, you know, and then, you know, in a few years when you're ready, you can do an hour. Mm. So, like, I'd been doing stand-up for 2 years. I went to Edinburgh with an hour, and it went all right, actually. And it had its ropey moments, and it wasn't the most brilliant show, but I learned a hell of a lot from doing it. And I think that was the start of me not listening to advice, because I know loads of people who wait years and years and years, then go and do an hour expecting to get a nomination, and they get totally ignored, and then they think, why didn't I do this 7 or 8 years ago, you know? Mm. So having sort of discovered the joys of doing an hour-long show and realising that I could tell more stories and explore things in much more depth, I got really addicted to that. So I got into the idea of putting on some of these shows. So I put on one or two and sold tickets, and they did okay. And I just thought, right, I'm going to do a tour. And then as soon as I started looking at it, I realised that the way to do that is you need to get an agent, or you need to get a tour management company on board. Oh, when we're back in the gatekeeper thing, how do you do that? Oh, well, when you're doing headlining this gig and this gig, it's like, oh, right, okay, back to square one. So I just decided to do it myself, just decided to have a go. And like a lot of things in life, a lot of successes come out of people not appreciating how hard something is going to be they start it. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into, and I sort of blundered into it, and it kind of worked out all right, you know. So that was how I got into it. It's all down to basically being old and impatient and not having time to piss about and needing to get on with things, you know. Mm.
And what? So I think the obvious question to ask now is, like, most comedians, when they're trying to put together a tour or even go to Edinburgh or do any of the big things that you think you want to do with an hour, for example, it's knowing that the hour is good, which obviously an award would validate in certain ways, and a competition thing would validate, or even having a industry person saying, I'd love to make money off you because I think it's good enough.
Yeah.
What did you do to get past the, I mean, if you had it, but like the insecurity of, I've only been doing this 2 years, is this show even good? You know what I mean?
Yeah. What did I do
to get past
it? Yeah, no, to get past the insecurity. I think that I believed in the story, and this is probably a key thing, really. So I knew I wasn't the funniest guy on the circuit. I knew I wasn't the most experienced. I knew that I made mistakes all the time. But I think I had faith in the fact that I was telling an interesting story. And it was a true story. So the first show was called Meditation Ruined My Life. And it was about, it's a true story of how I was a management consultant and I gave up everything, my home, career, possessions, everything, and went off to train as a Buddhist monk. And it was all triggered by me deciding to go to one meditation class in order to relax, and then this, my whole life unravelled. So it was a pretty, I think it's a pretty interesting story to hear from someone about basically how they gave up everything and had a big nervous breakdown and went to be a monk. So I suppose I believed in that story, so I knew that even if some of the comedy didn't work or I messed things up, you know, at least you've got a good story out of it. So that was a key thing. I did it on the free fringe anyway, so I figured people don't have to pay. I saw some things on the free fringe, and I think this is important when you first start out. Go and see stuff on the free fringe that you know is pretty almost certainly going to be terrible. And once you've seen that, you think, well, at least I'm not that bad. and that really helped. Go and see some, like, some stuff by some students, you know, a sketch show or something. So I watch people less experienced than me. And so you think, well, you know, all right, yeah, there is a lot of people out here who are learning and they're not good yet. And the audience accept that, you know. So yes, rely on the goodwill of the audience, basically. So that was all part of it. And, you know, the other thing that happened, you said about winning awards. I did actually win an award before I went to Edinburgh.
Okay.
I did a preview of the show at the Manchester Comedy Festival or whatever it was called that year. A different name every year. And I won an award for the show. And I got a 5-star review. And I think a lot of it was to do with, like, the place was packed out and a lot of the people in the audience knew me from one place or another. There were a lot of Buddhists there. Mm. And so the show flew. The people, the reviewers who were in the room, you know, are so swayed by the audience. Mm. They thought it was amazing. I was flying on confidence, so I did put in a good performance. It went great and I won an award. So I think when I went to Edinburgh, I was quite deluded that I was taking a really good show as well. So that gave me a lot of confidence. About halfway through the second week, I realised it wasn't quite as good as I'd thought. And I had a nervous breakdown. But I've since learned that that's normal because I've done that every time I've been to Edinburgh. So, So I think you've just got to... I think that the only way to do Edinburgh is to do it and do that full-length show. And you do get a lot of comedians who are really established, but... And they wait, and they go along to Edinburgh, and they do that first hour, and they still struggle. So my philosophy is get down there and do it. And the only downside is it disqualifies you from being nominated for Best Newcomer, you know. But the news is that most people who go, even after 10 years, don't get nominated for Best Newcomer.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't hold out for that one.
Exactly, yeah. No, I know what you mean. I did the Brighton Fringe last year, and to try and get people down in the first early shows, I emailed a lot of cat sanctuaries and Buddhist monasteries
yeah.
to get those. Cause I thought
yeah.
they're the people
yeah.
that will love it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And after the second show, it turns out it was full of Buddhists, right?
Yeah.
Who'd all come because they thought, oh, it's a show about us.
Yeah.
Right. It's not as much as they would hope, but they like had feedback and like
yeah.
criticism, and like some of them were like, this joke isn't as accurate. You've got this misquoted and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, I've
yeah.
got that misquote on purpose because I'm
yeah.
meant to be an idiot.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
you know, like,
yeah, yeah.
It's really annoying.
I know. Yeah,
they were lovely. But
yeah, no, I do know. I do know what you mean. I love doing the Brighton Fringe and I love doing Brighton. But I did like after Edinburgh with Meditation Ruined My Life. I went down to do the Brighton Fringe and. Because I had some really good reviews and stuff. I mean, I had some lousy reviews as well, but the main thing is get reviews, and obviously nobody saw the lousy ones. But I waved my good reviews from 3 weeks and people like that around. And I got this weekend at this really nice little theatre at the Brighton Fringe. I got Friday and Saturday night, and they seated 100, and it sold out both nights straight away. So I thought, oh yeah, I'm ace. And turned out I wasn't ace. And the show by then was like an hour and a half long with an interval because they wanted an interval to sell beer. So it's 2 hours of 45 minutes. So I'd put in some extra bits. And to be honest, some of the hour was a bit thin. But I went in, I thought, no, I can do this. And there were loads and loads of Buddhists there and quite a lot of other people who were quite sort of like right on sort of Brighton people. And I went out there and I died on my arse for 45 minutes. Then I sat in the dressing room with my head in my hands for 15 minutes. Then I came out and died for another 45. And I knew I had to come back and do it again the next night. It was horrendous. But it was really interesting that I had this, a similar experience where that people thought people. I talked to people afterwards, and some people came and spoke to me, and were, you know, and they just took what I said too seriously, and or they thought that because I was a stand-up comedian, and I did it in quite a stand-up-y way, that I was, you know, taking the piss out of them. And not all the jokes are directed at myself. And I had a really interesting experience with that as well, of being people being really earnest. And the next day I was being interviewed by a Buddhist magazine, so that was quite an interesting interview. So when I went and did the show the next night, I took out a couple of bits that were, that had been particularly taken amiss. And I did the first half sitting down. I just sat down. It took all the aggression out of it. Went absolutely fine. Same venue, same show, you know. And I suppose that's the thing that you learn from doing this sort of thing. But how could I have learned that without doing it?
Yeah.
It's a different thing doing a show in a theatre from doing stand-up in a club. And there are different rules. And you know, the only way to learn is to do it, really. And sometimes take a really bad hit for it, you know.
Yeah,
totally. So, yeah. And I'm waffling on quite a lot here. I'm quite...
It's absolutely fine. That's what my edit's for.
Yeah, good, good. It will get edited then, that's good.
Yeah.
But you'll leave this bit in, obviously.
So people know it's been
edited. Yeah, that's right. They think, oh, he's putting the work in.
Yeah.
We might as well sponsor it.
Yeah, that would be nice. So at what stage of... Because obviously, let me just work this out. You're 41 at this point?
41, 42.
And you've been doing comedy for 3 years?
Yeah.
You're honing the show around the place?
Yeah.
So it's not complete yet?
Yeah.
At what point did you think, I'm going to start booking this tour? Because obviously you're booking it like six or 8 months ahead of time.
No, I did. I didn't tour that meditation room in my life. I only did it. I did it at Manchester, Edinburgh and Brighton.
Okay.
Then I decided to write a new show, and I didn't write one, but I'd booked in at Edinburgh.
Right.
So I went and did a work in progress show at Edinburgh again, that you shouldn't do. So I did have about 3 hours of material, but a lot of it was untested, and some of it had only, you know, a lot of stories and things. And I just went out every day and did an hour's worth of it, and a lot of it died, and some of the shows turned into workshops where people were suggesting better punchlines, and which I gratefully took. And that was a nerve-wracking 3 weeks. That it was took a lot out of me. But God, what a brilliant! Can you imagine doing 22 hours of new material gigs? Like, you come out of it a better performer and with better material. So I did that year that I did that. That work in progress show, a lot of the material for the kindness show, which I toured, came out of that. So it was already tried and tested in that sort of festival environment. And then the following year, so this was my third Edinburgh, I took the kindness show to Edinburgh. It had a run there. And then that was when I decided, all right, I'm going to tour it. So I've done it. I toured the show then the following year, and we did 20 dates around the country, and I think they all sold out. I mean, as near as damn it. And then I went took the show back to Edinburgh the following year because I'd been so busy touring and things I hadn't written a new one. Yeah. But I thought, well, why not take it back? So I did, and it was better by then as well.
Yeah.
And then that was going to be it. But then I got picked up by a management company who wanted me to come back and do it at the Assembly Rooms the following year. So I wasn't going to turn that down, so I took it back again. Then I did a further 10 dates.
Okay.
Then, so yeah, so that's what I've done. So I've done like did like 30 dates in two stints, plus three Edinburghs with the show.
And when it came to picking where you were going to tour, like the show, how did you pick the cities?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So Manchester was a no-brainer because it's my hometown. Brighton.
Glad you mentioned that because not everyone would know that.
Yeah. So, hometown, Manchester, Brighton, which I mean, I did used to live down there, right? And it's full of Buddhists and lefty spiritual people who like the show. And all the people who hated me had found out they hated me by then, so they didn't come back, so that was good. So
nice I did, you eliminate
yeah, it is. I think that's a big part of it. That's a big part of it, isn't it? It's, you know, I mean, it's all about actually. This is a key thing for me, why I didn't want to do the weekend clubs, because I think there are two ways to go with anything, really. You can either be market-led or product-led, to use marketing speak, you know. So you can either say, right, what do people want? Right, I'll do that. Or you can say, what do I want to do? Right, I'll do that, and hopefully I'll find people who like it. And that was the thing that I realised. If you're doing the circuit, particularly the weekend clubs, to some extent you have to think about what they like and give them that. And
I don't do that.
So yeah, I know, well, neither did I. And it made life quite hard with some of that. You know, and some people might disagree with this, but, you know, and there are some exceptions, but I think to a large extent it is like that. So I think the thing is with doing your own show is you can do what you like, and it takes a while, but eventually you find your audience, and people who don't like you find out they don't like you and they stop coming, and that's great, you know. So so I did Manchester, Brighton, I did Leicester because I did the festival as part of the tour, so that was nice. And then the others, what I did was I just decided, like, right, I want to cover most of the country. And I just looked, well, where are the cities where they have a lot of one-man shows on? And where are the venues that seem to do those sorts of shows? So I did quite a lot of research into it, and I identified about 25 venues. Then I spoke to them and eliminated a few, based on the fact that they were really disorganised, and I thought, well, if they're more disorganised than me, it's probably not a good measure. So yeah, I ended up with 20 venues that I identified, so they were spread out around the country, and I managed to book it so that I did it over a 6-week period where I was able to like go down to one part of the country, you know, do a few, and they followed it, you know, a logical thing, so I wasn't in Hull one day and Brighton the next. And managed to coordinate it like that. Yeah,
that's pretty much what I've done mine as well.
Yeah,
I've tried to. So because I have a few friends who've done tours recently,
yeah.
And their management's like put them, like you said, in Hull and then Brighton, then
yeah,
Edinburgh. And
that's
then,
it.
Yeah, and that's fine. But if I'm doing it on my own steam, I'm sort of like, I'll do Brighton and I'll do Hastings and then I'll do Kent and then I'll work my way around.
That's it. Yeah, and you want to be fresh, don't you? As well, you know, you don't want to been travelling all the time, and you know.
Have you? Because it sounds like, and don't take this the wrong way, it sounds a bit like it was a scattergun approach in a way. It wasn't as organised as maybe you are now in terms of city choices.
No, it was really organised. That was when I got organised, really. That I knew I wanted to, like, I knew if I did two venues too close together, it wouldn't work, because people, you know, I know that I only felt like I could get a small, you know, if there's a catchment, however many tens of thousands in one city, I knew I was going to get a small percentage of that coming to the show. So I wanted the shows to be spread out so that they weren't competing with themselves, you see what I mean? So I chose different parts of the country, and then I chose what I thought was the best place within that part of the country. So it was really sort of planned down to, like, I know, right, I'm doing the southeast that week, the southwest that week, you know. So it was sort of very top-down planned.
And in terms of the venue, you said you're doing it in theatres rather than maybe pubs or clubs.
Yeah.
And how hard are they to negotiate with?
Well, the first tour that I did a variety of venues, and I did that for a reason, because I wanted to learn. And my objective with that first tour was to learn about touring. So I didn't expect it to sell as well as it did, and I expected to lose a load of money. But I figured, well, you lose a load of money when you go to Edinburgh, so what the hell? So I did a mixture of, I did some theatres, like studio spaces in really nice theatres. I did a couple of music venues, you know, where there's a lot of sort of bands and stuff, but they don't really do comedy or anything. I did a couple of comedy clubs, I think. You know, a real sort of mixture. I did one in like a sort of town hall-y sort of National Trust building, kind of. I don't even know what it was, but it was like this Tudor building, you know, in Shrewsbury, like this listed building, and I just hired it and did one in there. So I really tried out different venues, and what I learned from it was, yeah, next time just do theatres.
Did they have a problem working with, because I think a thing that would be in the back of most people's minds, I know it was with mine when I started booking my tour, is I imagine venues, a lot of venues I know are tied up anyway with places like Sea Tickets and stuff, so they won't deal with people without agents. But how did you find, especially, you know, were you very upfront, like, I've never done this before, what are your splits, what are you doing, you know?
Yeah.
How did you even negotiate deals?
Well, what I did was, I didn't negotiate deals, I hired.
Okay, right.
Yeah. I started getting into the whole negotiating deals stuff, and obviously a lot of the venues don't do those things anyway. They only do hire if you're doing the upstairs room of a pub or something, or a music venue, you know, they don't tend to do that, they just want to hire. A lot of the theatres, they were like, yeah, well, send us your CV and everything you've done and some reviews and some recommendations, and we'll book something in for about 12 months' time, and, you know, and maybe, well, we'll let you know in 3 months if you're in the programme, you know. And I realised, all right, yeah, I haven't got time for that, and it's quite likely they'll turn me down. So I just looked at the hiring situation. So what I did was, so that's kind of your choices, basically. You can either pay a fee and you hire the venue, and for that you'll get like some front of house staff, some techie help, stuff like that, various things thrown in. You pay the fee, but you get the ticket money, but you're taking all the risk. The alternative is a box office split, where you might, so you won't pay anything for the hire, but the venue will keep, say, 30% of the ticket price. So I just went for the hire option, and I worked out that in most cases, you know, if I sold half the tickets, that would cover my costs, I'd be all right, you know. So really, I'd have to sell like 25%.
Because I've booked my own thing, I'm part asking you questions on that, but also other people I know who know I've booked my own thing have sent me messages going, what did you do with that?
Yeah.
And I don't have answers for half of them.
Yeah.
Because, so my tour-wise, I contacted a bunch of venues that I started by contacting a load of promoters who've already seen me.
Yeah.
And said, I know you run a club.
Right.
Can I come and put my show on there? And then they said yes, or some of them said no, but some of them said yes. And then I contacted a load of venues that were near the ones that said no, and said, can I? I mean, I said to them, I'm going to do it this way then, is that okay? Because I didn't want to.
Yeah.
And I made sure it was on a day they don't have a gig, because it was respectful and stuff. So then I put them on there, and the venues have helped me with that. And then outside of that, I've contacted places that I know other people have gone and have done a show, and on the back of that, sort of networked with the person that went there before me, and done it that way. So it's interesting to me, the theatre split, you know, you hiring a whole theatre, as it were. I mean, I can imagine your anxiety level. I mean, that would
well, I mean,
drive me.
it's not too bad. It depends, really, and they vary a lot. So if you hire, like, so can't remember exact figures and things, but I hired like the Theatre Royal in Newcastle, nice theatre. I hired their studio, I think it seats about 120, something like that. You get put in their brochure. It's sold out in 2 days, because they send their brochure out to however many people, you know, and they're really good. Some venues are better than others. They were brilliant. They sold it out really quickly. But the amount they were charging, actually, you know, if I'd sold 20, 25% of the seats, I would have been okay, you know. So it wasn't too bad, but then you get others and, you know, they pile the costs on. I got my fingers really badly burnt last year, with a theatre where I decided to take a chance and go for like a 300-seater room, based on the fact that the other tour had sold so well. I thought, right, well, let's see, if I go for a big theatre, and one of the bigger, you know, still one of the smaller rooms, but still big for me, but I know that they've got a big marketing budget and all the rest of it, you know, actually, will they sell those because people are buying the venue, you know? Turned out they didn't, and they were the most expensive that I've hired, and they were probably the worst marketing team I've ever met.
Wow.
So that's the tricky thing, that you're relying on them to market the show, and so you need to sort of check them out. And generally, like, this theatre was part of a group of theatres run by the same one team on the council.
Right.
Yeah, they're overworked, they haven't got any sort of profit motive, they're not, you know.
Yeah.
And so I learned from that. So it can be scary, but I think the thing is, if you just look around, you can find some that are really well priced. Mm. And you know that they're a professional team, and you know you're going to do okay, providing you do the other things, which we can talk about in a minute, that are important.
Yeah, I was going to say, so let's pick a venue that you can remember our hire fee for. It doesn't matter where it is.
Yeah, I don't know if I can remember. Oh, okay, any, but anyway, yeah, but go on. I'll go.
If you went with a ballpark figure of
a
couple of £100?
Yeah, so some might be, I think there'd be more than that, but yeah, you might get some 250, something like that.
Okay.
Maybe.
And the next question would be, how did you price your ticket? Did you find out the hire fee, work out the number of seats, work out how many you need to sell, and then go from there? Or did they say, we need to sell it for this?
Yeah, well, sometimes the venues will have a set price, but even if they don't, I always ask, well, what do you charge? And I get on their website and see who else is on and what they're charging. It's really important you don't underprice yourself, because people use, you know, and you'll know this has been a marketing person, but given a lot of unknowns, people will use the price of something as a guide to how good it's likely to be. So if you charge a fiver and everyone else is charging 12 quid, people aren't going to come because they think, oh, it's going to be five down the drain. So I charge whatever everyone else is charging. And that's worked out absolutely fine, even when I'm the other people. Well, in fact, if you think about it, if I'm playing... So this has happened, like, I played a venue in Oxford, and I think just before I was on, in that same week, Joe Lycett was on, obviously done a lot of TV and stuff. Alfie Moore was on, who's got his own radio show, and I charged the same as them. Now, the thing is, people are going to look in that programme, and they might recognise Joe, and they might recognise Alfie, and then they don't recognise me, but I'm the same price at the same venue. They're going to assume, all right, okay, he's going to be decent. That's how it works. Whereas what happens is the little insecure voice says, oh, God, I can't charge the same as them. I haven't got a Radio 4 show. But actually, no, that's not the way to do it. You've got to charge the going rate for that venue. Because some people will like me who don't like Alfie, you know, and vice versa, you know, it's not like that. So to some people it is worth that money. So so I priced it based on what the venue charge, and then I would weigh it up and look at the capacity, how switched on they are, how many people their brochure goes out to, and, you know, working out the sums of, well, how likely am I to get my money back.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I've had a little insecure voice a lot recently, where I've gone, you know, don't go too high because no one,
yeah.
but no one will buy them.
Yeah.
And I'd rather make less of a loss than no. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's good to hear that I'm the only one that's had that.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I think it's a really common thing for people to underprice themselves, and it's a big mistake. I get really insecure as well. I get totally panicky, usually 2 weeks before each show, because I found that hardly anyone buys tickets until like the final week. Mm. So like I have total heart attacks every single time, thinking nobody's coming to this show. Nobody's coming to this show. Shall I pull the show? You know. So I go through all the same panics, but generally it's worked out okay.
Yeah, I always compare it to the kind of Chinese takeaway thing where yeah. like the price is too low.
Yeah.
I question what's in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which I don't know if that's fair to do or anything, but like yeah. it's the same. I think with comedy, that's the same thing.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. So I think if you're going to hire, find out how much the hire fee is, what the capacity is, what they normally charge for a show like yours, and then do your sums and see, you know, how many people do you think you're going to have to get in to make it okay.
Mm. And in terms of promoting a show then, mm. especially in a city that maybe you've never been to before,
yeah.
have no profile in,
yeah.
they don't know who you are,
yeah.
and you don't know how the ecosystem...
You know, when you put it like this, it sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Believe me, my parents got quite supportive of me recently, and then I turned around to them and went, I'm going to go on a tour, and they were like, oh, who's doing that? And I was like... I'm doing this,
yeah.
and their support quickly went.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they were very happy because I started getting loads of like paid weekend clubs and stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
as soon as I sort of went, but I want to take that show on a tour because I didn't get Edinburgh this year, so that yeah. would be good. Yeah, it's you sound mental.
Yeah,
but yeah.
yeah
so yeah, but it is the case of a lot of the cities I'm going to.
Yeah.
I have no profile in. I might have done yeah. one, you know, progression spot or a paid yeah. gig at a club, but no one knows who I am. I didn't keep in contact with the people that came up to me afterwards and went, "You were great. I'd
yeah.
love to see more."
Yeah.
of, you know, that kind of thing, which I'm now doing more of.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I bought business yeah. cards. I give them out at gigs,
yeah.
and they've got my website on and Twitter and whatever. And you know, I've got
yeah,
a mailing
yeah.
list that I sign people up to. And I presume you do something.
Yeah.
Similar.
Well, at Edinburgh, we have. So what I've always done is had a mailing list that people can sign up to after the show. In fact, one year I did a thing where you could win a Kindle. Because Kindle sort of sounds like kindness, it was the nearest thing I could do. But you can win a Kindle if you join the mailing list.
Okay.
And so that was interesting because I did wonder if people afterwards would not, you know, would drop out because they were just in it for the Kindle. But, you know, they didn't actually. And I think it just encouraged people to think, oh, I'll sign up. And funnily enough, the following year I was in Edinburgh and someone shouted my name and this woman came running over and she said, I'm the woman who won the Kindle. So at least I've got one fan, you know.
Yeah.
But, so
did
it
she
really
buy your book for it, though? That's the question.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the book isn't out yet, but hopefully she will. Hopefully she will.
Mm.
But, yeah, so I have collected those mailing, you know, but I've still not done it as well as I should have done. But, you know, enough that... So promoting it, there's a few things that I did for just that scenario where I haven't been somewhere before. But before we get onto that, I think, like, the key thing about it is... So I did... I spoke at the Chortle Comedy Conference a couple of years ago about the tour thing, and some people were quite indignant. And one guy said to me, "Well, how did you do it? I can't believe it. You know, like, I've never heard of you." And I was like, "Well, maybe I don't want you to come." You know, and it's like because he obviously never got my marketing because he's not, you know, my demographic. But it's also that the mistake there, and this is what I was trying to get across that day, and nobody was hearing it, was virtually nobody came to see me. People came to see the show.
Mm.
Last week, I went to a play in Manchester. I couldn't tell you the name of one person who was in it, you know. But I went because I heard the title. I thought, that sounds interesting. I saw the poster. I thought, that looks interesting. I read the blurb. I thought, that sounds like an interesting story. I'll go and hear that story, and I went to see it, and it was great. I still couldn't tell you who did it, or, you know. And I applied the same principle to my thing. Nobody's coming to see me, they're coming to see the show. And the show has a good title. It's just called Kindness, because I read somewhere that one-word titles are much more successful, and I don't know if it's true, but anyway, so I just called it Kindness. It's a word that is also a value, so a lot of people chime with it, that it resonates with them. Yeah, you know, I believe in kindness. It had a really nice design, done by Brennan Rees, who now has just won English Comedian of the Year and gone to Australia. Incidentally, the flyer for Meditation Room My Life was designed by Joe Lycett, who subsequently got a TV career. So if anybody wants to volunteer to design my flyer for free, I can guarantee you, just for once, I would like to be funnier than the person who designed my flyer, you know.
I wouldn't put that guarantee on
a paper, but no, yeah. But you know. So Brenda did a great job with the logo. So I didn't even have my face on the poster. I had the logo of the show, which is like a sun and a cloud, sun like looking after a sad cloud.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And the word kindness above it. And then in the blurb, it tells quickly the story of how I gave up everything and went to be a monk, and then how I had to leave that and become a single parent, how it's much easier to be kind as when you're living with monks than it is when you're living with a teenage girl, you know. And that's it. And that is what people bought. Because they heard the title, they thought, yeah, kindness, yeah, I believe in kindness. They saw the logo, it was eye-catching, they read the blurb and thought, that sounds like an interesting story. And I bet loads of people who saw it and liked it couldn't tell you who did it. But yeah, Hopefully they're on my mailing list.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a really key thing to get across, because if you go out, like, you know, and say, oh, well, yeah, I'm a new comedian, no one's ever heard of me, that is not a USP, do you know what I mean? There's a lot of people selling on that, you know. And even actually, if you've been on Radio 4, well, actually, there's loads of people been on Radio 4, you know. So it's so hard to sell yourself as a personality if nobody knows who you are, you know.
Yeah.
So you don't do that.
Everything only works if you know the name.
Exactly, yeah. So the key thing about the whole show is having a great story that you can tell in a blurb very quickly that will hook people, having a good title and a good theme and good graphics, and that's what will bring people in. So on that basis, like the marketing that I did, right, so there are a number of things. I think the most important thing is the brochure of the venue, or their email mailing list. And I think I got really lucky with that first tour, because I didn't really know what I was doing. But just from working with people who sounded over the phone like people I wanted to work with, who knew what they were doing, and from what they said about how they market, because that's a key thing, ask them about how they're going to market the show. Some of them say, oh, well, no, we're not going to do it, it's up to you. At that point, say thanks and put the phone down. What else is on at that venue and whether people trust it. So that's another reason people go to a show, is because they like that the venue. Some people will go to every show that's on in a particular little venue.
It's like the Soho Theatre and the Leicester Square Theatre.
Yeah, perfect. They've got a massive, yeah. That's it, yeah. Soho Theatre, yeah. Brilliant. It's exactly the same sort of thing. So those are important. So then brochure or mailing list. I did one at a music venue in Cambridge. That was a really successful music venue, and I know that they've I can't remember the name of it, but it's a big pub that's on like a roundabout. It's the most unpromising venue.
I think it's the one I've just emailed. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, sorry.
Right. Interesting. And it seats, I think it's seated it's about it's 90.
It's in the back of it.
Yeah.
They've reconverted it.
Yeah.
I literally did a gig there, and then I said to them, I want to come back here.
Right, because they have a comedy night. I'd forgotten that.
I forgot what it's called. It's a really nice
and it was interesting, like, but again they sold it out in no time because the people they've got a big following at that venue. The problem I had at that one and another music venue I played is that a lot of them came to that venue, obviously regularly come, and they were so blasé about getting in for the start of the show, I couldn't get them in. And there was, because they didn't really have front of house like they have in a theatre. So I ended up trying to shepherd people in. And while I'm shepherding people in, people are escaping to the bar. Yeah. Some people are still ordering food. And it was a nightmare. The show started almost an hour late, by which time people who were there on time were getting rested. It was really tricky. So watch out for that. If you do it, maybe get some people down to, you know, spell it out to the venue what that you wanted to start. People's got to start on time. But apart from that, really nice. But yeah, so they had a great mailing list. The big theatres are great because as long as it's not council run and as long as they're only running one theatre and they can focus on that one theatre, if you get in the brochure, you know, that goes out to loads of people. And again, just the fact you're in it validates your show. So mainly I got them to do the marketing. The only thing that I really did was Facebook ads. So you're more of a social media guru than me, and so it'd be interesting to see what you think about this, because the Facebook ads seemed to really work on the first tour. The second tour, not so much, and I'm not quite sure why.
What do you mean by worked?
Well, so I did a different campaign for each venue, and the great thing is you can really target it.
Yeah.
So I could target it people who lived within a certain radius of the venue, who were interested in meditation or Buddhism or various other kindness or compassion or various other things, yoga, you know, basically thinking about my demographic, about who's liked the show before. And I realised that most people who like the show are people, lefty liberals, who've kind of a bit of a spiritual bent to them, who are sort of between basically people like me, people, you know, over 30, between 30 and 55, you know, that's kind of that's my group. So I targeted those ads at those people, and then it's good because you can measure the impact of it, so you can see how many people saw the ad, how many of those people clicked through, and then on your ticket sales you can see how many of the, you know, whether it's had a bearing on the ticket sales. And it seemed to really work well, and you can work out, well, is this worth it, how much is it costing me per ticket sold, and that seemed to work really well. And also people liked, I had a page for the show which I've still got, and people would like that as well when they click through on the Facebook ad, so that enabled me to put more messages out to them and remind them. And that was all I did, and it seemed to work pretty well.
How long ago was this tour?
So this was 2014.
Okay. I can answer the question if you want me to.
Right, yeah.
This is now me being interviewed. Pages have changed quite a lot.
Right.
That's the first thing you should be aware of. The shortest answer to this is Facebook went public.
Right.
I think it was at the end of 2014 or start of 2015.
Yeah.
Which meant that they needed to make more money for the shareholders. And the way they decided to do that was adverts, but also, okay, so they wanted to change the model for advertising. So instead of it just being the sidebar things that not everyone really looks at, if we're honest, they started charging brands to push their messages out more via pages. So it means that your reach on your page will have dropped massively organically.
Right, okay.
So you have to pay for your post to go out to even the people that have liked the page.
Yeah.
Which means that your adverts are going to cost more in the sidebar because they're not as useful for anyone, but also, yeah, that needs to work out. And the fact that your posts are being seen by less people means that less people who even like your work or know what your work is won't see what you're talking about unless you post it more. And if you post it too many times, someone that sees it a lot might unlike, and then you've lost someone else. So in many ways, Facebook is shooting themselves in the foot to try and make a very short-term amount of profit.
Right.
And and it's only because they haven't thought through how to monetize the site. It makes sense on paper to charge brands to advertise, because brands have always been the ones that pay for adverts. You know, like, they buy a poster on the Underground or whatever because 20,000 people walk past it.
Yeah.
Same kind of model. You know, you can target it to 20,000 people and they'll charge you for it. However, for individuals like you and me, it doesn't work out on bulk because adverts are about awareness, not about sales.
Yeah, that's it.
So as a result, you know, when you see, it's like when you see someone sharing a sunglasses image, like, because they've been, you know, tagged in a thing from someone they shouldn't have added, right? No one's bought sunglasses ever from Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
Not one person alive has ever done that. Yeah. I guarantee you, right? Mm. And if they have, they're mad, right? It doesn't. It's not somewhere you go for it.
No, absolutely.
But they still happen because people want the site to. They want the click through, just so that the site is aware, or it's in your history, so that when you start typing in sunglasses, it filters it or whatever. It's it's a much bigger thing than
that.
So that's why it probably isn't as effective anymore.
Interesting. Oh well, that sorts that one out. So it's interesting. So, I mean, I've got other sort of thoughts. I mean, my
it's the reason why I have a group instead of a page.
Right.
I keep encouraging people to make groups instead of pages.
I'm gonna write that down.
Because well, here's the thing. So when you post on a page, up to 10% of your likes will organically get to see it.
Yeah.
So if you have 1,000 people on a page, 100 people will see it, roughly, right, at most. And then you have to pay for more people to see it. In a group, everyone gets an alert, unless they've specifically opted out.
Yeah.
And very rarely do you opt out, because the group is about a community of people that share an interest, whereas a page is a one-way dialogue.
Yeah, that's true.
So for me, I want this podcast, for example, to have a community around it, so we can all share information and try and evolve together and have a group of people that actually want to work on the better of this industry. I know a lot of podcasts that have pages and it works for them and it's fine, but it's because they just want to syndicate the episode out and get, you know, just get the downloads and stuff, and that's fine. I'm judging it from the outside, but or maybe they just got a page because they didn't know groups are more useful in that way. For me, I know that, for example, immediately when I put a podcast out, I have about 800 members in my group now, and I get about 400 downloads direct from that.
Wow,
because
good.
Because it comes through.
Oh, good. That's helpful. Yeah. I mean, I think one, I've got a couple of things that I'm really sort of starting to, well, I'm going to be ramping up, really. So one of them is about social media. I need to do a lot more on it, and I haven't really pushed it as well as I should have. The other thing that I'm doing a lot of is speaking. Speaking at events, because I found that just doing the silent shows just to not taking off, I don't know what it is, you know, apart from
I'd be better when I'm quiet,
tape face maybe an exception, but so I've got 50 locations that I want to develop for tour locations.
Okay.
And I go around the country and I speak at all sorts of events on subjects related to my shows, things I'm interested in my shows. Mm. And basically I do lots of bits out of my show. And because it's not comedy, it's often bored business people. They're absolutely delighted. So I'm doing more and more of that. I do stuff like that for money as well, which is nice. So that's basically how I stay alive, is the corporate work. But I'm doing more and more of these little things for free, because to groups who I realise are my my audience. So if I would say I was doing the circuit, I would be on to a bunch of people who've just turned up to see some comedy. They're a bit drunk. You're one of a number of acts, probably not the best one. And they go away, and they might say, that bloke was good, but they've no idea who you are. But if you know who your audience is, you can find other ways to get in front of those audiences. That's a really good way to build a following, and that's really what I'm working on at the moment. I'm getting around doing these little speeches and talks and getting involved, and it is that community thing. It's about tapping into these communities who are going to be interested in your sort of material.
Yeah, I mean, the internet has made it a lot easier to build a community.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to be restricted geographically. You know, take my podcast for example, just because we're on that. You know, I've got a lot of people in Japan who are comedians who listen to it. A bunch of people in Germany, and a few people now. Like, it's getting pushed around America. Yeah. It started in New York and in LA, and now some people in Oregon. I got an email from someone in Oregon the other day who was like, "Love it! I'm learning so much.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that this podcast even existed and stuff," which is great because, you know, love it when email me. I love it when people email me. But also it feels good that, you know, it's not as big a world as you think it is, and we're all in this together.
Yeah.
And I think that attitude is slightly lost on the circuit sometimes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's that whole, you did really well, fuck, I've got to go on now. You know
what I
mean?
Yeah, so, I know.
And
I know.
And it's sort of like, it doesn't have to be like that. We could all have a good gig.
Yeah,
you know what
that's
I mean?
It, I know.
Yeah.
I know, it's all those little insecurities, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the community thing is it. But I mean, I think in terms of most of the success that I have had, you know, even though, I mean, I should say, I'm playing small rooms, like 100 to 150 generally. But they've mainly sold out because of the venue and their marketing team and their brochure. So I think that's the most important thing, and the reputation of the venue.
You can say, the only reason I've had success is because the venue has done a lot of the work, and that is great. Because
so the skill is in choosing the venue. That's what I'm saying, really.
Yeah, and it is, but it is a team effort, and I understand that. As much as I'd love to sit here and go, well, my shows are selling out really well.
Yeah,
I know that the, you know, venues are putting in a lot of effort.
Yeah.
I'm putting in a lot of effort because it works both
it
ways.
And it's what you give them to work with. Again,
yes.
If you give them, you know, well, I'm Sam Brady, and this is my Sam Brady's comedy show, they're not going to be able to sell that.
Yeah. And I mean, what other red flags have you come across in terms of venues, like when you're talking to them? Obviously disorganized, but
so so things like them not returning calls or not doing what they say they're going to do, and you know, we all get a little bit of that with promoters and things like that, and everyone's busy. But I think if you're relying on this venue to sell your show, and you could lose me, you know, basically you've got to expect them to be professional and more efficient than you are. That's my rule. You've got to be more organised than I am. Other things are having a checklist of things to ask them. So a lot of it is the standard stuff that you would ask if a pub wanted to put on a comedy night. You know, will the bar be closed? Is it a separate room? You know, is there, you know, what's the seating arrangements and stuff like that? So even in a theatre, you have to ask these things just to make sure. You need to ask them what marketing they'll be doing and expect a comprehensive answer. You need to ask them what is included. So if they start wanting to charge you for using a projector or a screen or to have someone at front of house or, you know, so it's all those things. And then here's one. So here's a killer tip, right? So this is, I think this is a really good one. Hard earned. A lot of theatres now have systems where you can choose your, with allocated seating, so you can choose your seat. Really bad idea for us. What happens is that people will come in and choose seats right at the back. So unless you sell out, you can end up with people scattered all over the place and sitting at the back miles from you. The other thing is that if you're unknown, people go on and they see, there's only two people have bought tickets. Maybe this is going to be shit. So they hold off and everyone holds off. And I didn't have this problem at all the first year because none of the venues had allocated. Now they brought these systems in. I had two venues that had difficulty selling this year, and both of them had allocated seating. And I could see, because you go on, you go to buy a ticket, and you can see that, oh, there's nobody going. So what I would say is, first of all, ask, is it allocated seating? Can they choose their seats? Can they see how many seats have gone? If they say yeah, ask, can you switch that off so they don't have it for this thing? if they say no, we can't switch it off, and you really, really want to do that venue, what you can do is ask them to only release the tickets in blocks. So that's what we did, and it worked out really well. So we got them to, at this one particular venue, they just released like the first few rows first. So when people went on, it looked like it was pretty much sold out, but there was some space at the front. And then when those went, they released the next block. And that worked out okay.
Okay.
But it's definitely an important question to ask them about the allocated seating, because it can really stuff you, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine. I had a friend of mine do a gig a while ago, which was in a theatre, and he took a photo from the side of the stage and was like, this is going to be really awkward.
Yeah.
And it was literally because the back rows had all sold. The what's it called? The first circle thing had got like the odd people, and then you had just twos and threes all over the place.
Yeah.
And he said it was awful. He said it was fine, but it was just really awkward for him.
Really difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So so that's that is a good tip.
No, that's a good tip. And what are good things to look out for in venues? So like when you're trying to, so when you're assessing a venue, say you've got a short list of five venues in a city.
Yeah.
How do you personally sort of, obviously, if they've all things equal, so you know, they don't like
same
one has
price and all of that.
Yeah.
So one of the key things for me is how enthusiastic are they about having your show?
Do you send them a recording of the show? Or?
No, I mean, I haven't done that. You could do that. I think at the time, I don't know if I had a decent recording of it. But no, and sometimes you can tell, like, the person. So if the person you're dealing with, they're usually a quite small team, even in a big theatre. They're the person who's going to have to sell the show, and sometimes they will really chime into like, "Oh, I get it," you know, like they're the kind of person who, if they didn't work there, would buy a ticket and come.
Right.
And they're excited, like, "Oh, this is great!" And because they're excited about it, they'll sell it more. And they know exactly how to sell it. And sometimes people are like, "Oh yeah, great, yeah, you're in this date, yeah. Why have you phoned me again? There's nothing to discuss," you know. So I look for the enthusiasm of the person. Also, and I got this tip from a programmer in a theatre, ask who is going to be doing the marketing and try and get a relationship with that person. Don't be dealing through a third person. Get a direct relationship. So their enthusiasm. Then the other thing is, it's about what other shows are on. Have they got other stuff on that's like what you do? If you can, phone up the acts and ask them what they know about the venue. And then the other stuff is all just the same old stuff that you get in a comedy club about. Is it a nice low ceiling? Is it got, you know, the usual stuff that makes a good room for comedy, really. Yeah.
Okay. And what was the hardest part when you first did your first tour about sourcing venues?
The hardest part was, it was all hard, to be honest, at first. But the thing is, like, if you go to a tour management company, what they will do is something like this, right? They've got a big database full of all the venues. With notes against each one and different criteria against them from experience. They get your show, they'll run a filter on their list to filter the ones that they think are the right size and the right sort of thing. They hit a button and email your blurb through automatically to all these theatres, and the theatres see that it's come from, you know, this particular tour management company. Oh, we know them, we've dealt with them before. Yeah, let's have a look. We'll take this show. So all they do is they bang that out, and then they wait and see what comes back at them in terms of, yeah, we're interested, and then they go through and negotiate dates. And that's basically what they do. The only difference is you don't have that big database when you start out, but as you do this more and more, you build those relationships and you get those venues. Now, if you were going through a management company, you never get those relationships. So it was really hard at first, finding the theatres, finding out who does hires, who's got a suitable room, talking to them, vetting them, seeing out who's keen. pricing and all of that, it takes a long time. And then the next difficult thing is trying to get them on the right dates and negotiating with them, and then having to phone them and say, actually, can I move you? Because I've got this other venue and they can only do this date, you know, and there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and a lot of waiting for people to get back to you. And so it's all quite a ball ache, and it takes months, you know, because presumably you've got other things to do as well, you know. But I think once you've done it once, it gets easier. And the other great thing is that once you've, like, so I did 20 venues my first tour because I'm an idiot. But
don't say it, I've just got 24 in.
Have you? Excellent, even bigger idiot than me. Didn't I do? Yeah, didn't I tell you that would be okay? Yeah,
you did,
no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. But you don't. But you don't have to do that. And
don't tell me that now.
No, but it's great though. I mean, I would do 20, I would do 40, 50 if I could, you know. It's just, touring is, just something I've forgotten to say, touring is absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
it's such great fun to go to different places and, like, do your show, and everyone's come just to see you, even, you know, no matter how many there are. It's amazing, so, yeah, well worth it, more the better. But you don't have to do that if you don't want to take such a big financial risk, or you haven't got that much money to put into it, or, you know, or time. You know, if you just put together a string of three or four shows and then keep doing it, you can carry on doing your show. This is another rule that, oh, you have to do a new show every year, you know, that, where this comes from. You know, there are enough theatres and venues in the country, you could do your little show for the rest of your life, you know. I don't mean your little show, just personally. I mean, like, one's little show.
No, go ahead.
I don't mean to run it down at all.
Right at the end of the
podcast. Yeah. But, so, you know, just start small, but building those relationships up is good. And, yeah. So, yeah, there was another point, but we'll probably come on to it in a second.
There's two questions that have just come out of that. One, have you found certain days of the week are better and worse? And I'm sure it will vary from city to city. And secondly, I think the most important thing I learned with mine is how far ahead certain venues book.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people sort of get off the back of Edinburgh
and
then go, oh, I should really take it around the place. Yeah. And you look at, I mean, you know, I don't know it for sure, but I know Soho have pretty much booked up.
I mean, places like Soho, they're booked up really early.
So how far ahead did you get? So when you started booking it to when you went on it, how far for you was it?
It was about 6 months before, and I think that's like the minimum you can do it. I think 6 to 9 months if you're hiring, if you're going on a box office split, 9 to 12 to possibly more. It takes you have to book in quite a long time in advance.
And you said that most of the places were selling, like, the tickets sold in the last 2 weeks before the show.
Most of them, yeah. There were one or two that sold really quickly because they were brilliant venues with a brilliant brochure, but most of them sold in the, you know, the last 10 days, which is absolutely nerve-wracking.
6 months of anxiety. Yeah. Great, that's what everyone wants to hear.
I know.
Okay, well, these are the final quick-fire questions.
Okay.
I do them quickly. You can take as long as you want. Although I will tell you now, it is just under 10 past. So,
right. When you need to leave. I'll need to go soon.
Okay. What do you think is the biggest problem in the touring section of the comedy industry, and how would you go about solving it?
I think maybe the biggest problem with the touring part of the industry is down to people being told they need permission to do stuff. It's like this in everything. I know this is the bee in my bonnet, and I'm like this with everything. Whether it's publishing a book or doing a tour or whatever, in every industry there are a lot of middlemen who've got an interest in you not doing things. They've got to protect, you know, agents and managers have got to protect their acts and keep certain territory available for them. And part of that is useful because it's a quality marker, but often it isn't. So I think it's the biggest problem is people being told, you can't do this, you have to get an agent, you have to get a management company, you have to do this. And that's what puts people off. Whereas if we had a much more enabling attitude, where we all get together and say, well, actually, we can do this, and this has been my experience, this is what I've done. We can build, like a really sort of, like in music, there's a really sort of good sort of indie scene of bands who build followings, do their own stuff, do their own shows, and they do perfectly well. There'll still always be the superstars and the different levels and the people who are playing bigger venues, but there's no reason that there can't be this touring circuit of small studio venues of people doing different stuff. And that's the other thing, is that if we're not careful, everything turns out very samey. And we need people to be able to believe that they can do the stuff that they want to do that's different and interesting and find their audience. What we don't need is a whole load of people who believe that in order to succeed they have to do the same as what everyone else is doing, because that doesn't help anyone. So that's what I would say. It's, we have to encourage everyone to have a go and believe and back yourself and believe in your material.
Do you, I mean, because there's that cliche of comedians being lazy or unorganised or just not, or admin adverse, as it were. I mean, do you think that's like, I mean, do you think that's a comedian problem, or do you think that's a sort of promoter industry problem?
I think it's a human problem.
Oh, okay, fine.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's like often if you, I've had this conversation a few times with people, agents and managers and stuff, and I ought to say as well that I do have some really good relationships with lots of agents and managers. I'm not so, what was the question?
The question was, well, no, because you said that it's, we should all back ourselves, we should all and believe in ourselves more. But I think to a certain degree this is true, but I think it's a cliche and it's not 100% true for everyone.
Oh, right, about the lazy thing
and
all that. That was it, yeah.
So I was trying to work out whether it's, or in your opinion, whether it's a comedian problem, in other words, we're just not work shy, but we can't be bothered with the admin of that, and we want someone to do it for us. And then comes in the problem that there's gatekeepers.
Right.
Or do you think it's, we don't want to go for the gatekeepers because they're only going to say no anyway, or they have enough work, so why would they want mine?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if it's a comedian problem or a gatekeeper.
No, I think, I think it's a human problem, and the reason is that everyone experiences doubt and feels like a fraud. Everyone does. If you don't at some time feel like a fraud, you're probably a psychopath. You know, we all feel like that. And even the most successful comedians feel like frauds a lot of the time. So if there's somebody telling us that we can't do stuff, we're probably going to bottle out a lot of the time. The other thing is, like, a lot of comedians work really hard and are pretty organised. And, you know, this is one of the things I was going to say. I've had conversations with agents and managers where they'll talk about someone who's on TV and doing really well and making a lot of money and touring big theatres and things. And they'll say, but they've worked so hard. And you think, yeah, but does that mean that everyone else hasn't worked hard? Mm. I know some people who've worked hard in this industry for 10, 15, 20 years, and they're still doing pretty much the same gigs that they were doing. And, you know, bloody hell, well, they're not working in an office or doing a crappy job. They've still got the best job in the world. Mm. But to say, you know, they work really hard. Mm. So, you know, I don't think it's about that. I think it is just this thing that, you know, probably some years ago it was impossible to do these sort of indie tours and you know, without being on TV and radio. But it's not impossible anymore. You just need to believe and get out and do it. And, you know, you have to, what you do has to be good, or enough people have to like it. That's more what it is. Like, the thing with my shows is they're not the funniest show. It's not the funniest show in the world. It's not the anything-ish show in the world, apart from that it's the most my show in the world. And some people absolutely love it. Some people absolutely hate it, and that's fine. They don't have to come anymore. But some people absolutely love it because they like me and they really chime into the story and my view of the world. So the only thing you have to be the best at is putting yourself across and getting people to see you, and you'll find your audience. You know, that's my belief. I should also say, just as a quick thing, And you can tag this in somewhere. So I have worked with management companies. So I worked with Lakin McCarthy at Edinburgh last year because they came to see the show at the previous Edinburgh and they booked me in through the stand to do the assembly rooms. Beautiful venue. First time I've played above street level in Edinburgh. Such a luxury. Yeah. But, you know, suddenly I've got chandeliers, you know. Really lovely venue, lovely to be looked after, to have a street team and all of that stuff and not be doing the free fringy stuff, and really enjoyed it, and they did a great job, you know. So it's not like I'm against that stuff, I just don't have enough time in my life to wait around for them.
Yeah.
And you know, there's every chance that perhaps the next tour I'll do with them and they'll book it for me. Mm. But I might not now, and I've actually got the choice because I've now got 30 venues that, you know, and I would redo 25 of them, so I've got 25 venues that I already know will book me. I've just been booked by the Lowry on a box office split to do a work in progress show in their studio on the basis that I've proven myself by doing my own tours, and they know that, well, you know, basically if I'm willing to do that and put myself out there, I'm professional enough, they can trust me and work with me. So that relationship's come out of that. Because of that, I'm now getting taken more seriously by other theatres who also are interested in programming me on a box office split. Mm. Plus, I've got references from 25 theatres who all say, yeah, it's so show sold out, it was good. Mm. All of that goes a long way. So where I started out a couple of years ago, not being able to get programmed and having to hire, I now can start getting things that I wouldn't have otherwise got unless I'd been on TV or had an agent. So that gives me a lot more options, you know, and it makes it a lot easier for me to go to a manager and say, well, yeah, I'd like you to do this, but I could do it myself. What can you offer me, you know? So I'm not saying don't ever go mainstream. I'm just saying you don't have to wait for it. There are ways of proving yourself and building your following that can get you there without you just having to wait around for your lucky break.
That was Sam. As someone who's just spent like sort of the last 2 months putting together his own tour on his own with, again, roughly the same place he was, you know, no profile, no backing, no management, all that stuff. It was just really fun to talk to someone who's done it, been there, done well, and it's really given me a boost to not only like promote my stuff more and better, but to, you know, believe that it's gonna go well. You know, we all have that anxiety feeling that creeps in as soon as we've done something big or scary or new to us, and it's kind of just alleviated a lot of that. And it's kind of just made me think, well, you know what, it might go wrong, but at least I've tried, at least I've done it. And I think that's a much better and much more healthy attitude towards touring. I hope you got a lot out of that, and I hope if you are considering putting together a tour, do it. Like, do try. If you think you've got a show and you think you've got a show that's good enough to tour, don't wait for someone's permission. If you can't find someone to back you, back yourself. Seriously, that's the best way of doing it. If you have any questions, follow up. You can find all of Sam's details in the show notes or the pod notes. And also, if you join the Ask the Industry podcast group on Facebook, which is called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously, you can ask questions to all other performers and comedians. And if we have the answers, if I have the answer, if you need a question about touring, come ask me. I'm glad to share the information. I spent hours on these. I don't know why you think I wouldn't answer a Facebook post. So yeah, we're all in this together, and it's great to share information. So please join the Facebook group, and you can also ask future guest questions in there as well. Very quickly, if you live in Brighton, Hastings, Kent, Loughborough, Derby, or Norwich, those are the places my tour are coming to next. So if you can come down and look and watch my show called Buddhism and Cats. If you've already seen it, you don't necessarily have to come see it again, unless you'd like to, in which case, I love you. Thank you very much for coming. But if you'd like to come, that'd be great. The link is in the show notes for all the tickets and all the details of venues and stuff. It's also on my website, which is simonkane.co.uk. If you can't make any of those dates, I'm coming to other places. It's just I'm only going to plug the ones that are directly ahead of me, if that makes sense. If you can't come to the show or you don't want to come and see me, that's fine. You can always support the podcast by donating on PayPal via my website, which is called simonkane.co.uk. That's simoncaine.co.uk. If you want to become a regular donator and you want to become a patron of the pod,
First of all, thank you so much for doing that. It's invaluably helpful, and it really gives me sort of a budget and support and future help for the show so that I know that it can carry on and be hopefully on its way to becoming sustainable. You can sponsor the show from $1, which is 80p. So if you would like to do that and you think that it's, you think what you've just heard is worth 80p, right, please donate. Please do consider becoming a patron. You can also cap it. A few people have been asking me about that. So if you can only afford $2 a month, you can cap it at that. I produce 3 pods a month, so you don't have to, like, it's not going to break the balance. And the site is very good at capping your money so that you don't overspend or go into debt or anything. I don't want anyone else going into debt for this project other than me. One last thing. A few months ago, my book, How to Make a Living by Working for Free, came out, and I was sorting, and I'm currently sorting it out with Amazon to get it formatted. And I've had a few people inquire and buy copies post the crowdfunding. You can still do that. If you would like a copy, contact me somehow. You can get me on Twitter at ThisMadeMeCool. Just DM me, or you can find me on Facebook. I'm called Simon Kane on there. I haven't changed my name or anything. Or you can email me, which is Simon, S-I-M-O-N, .m.mother.caine@gmail.com. Just send me a message however you like, with whatever version you'd like. I'm going to have digitals and paperbacks, and you can buy one. I'm more than happy to buy it and ship it to you outside of the Kickstarter, and that'd be great. I would love to get to, you know, just like 100 books sold. That'd be amazing. So if you would like to contribute to that, feel free. The book is all about how to build an audience using free content online, but it also has an entire chapter on why you should pick yourself, on why you should not wait around to be discovered, and why actually picking yourself increases the chances of you being discovered, and the psychology behind that, and also the reasoning behind that from a business point of view. So if that sounds interesting to you, you can buy it. So it's £5 for a digital download, or £11 for a paperback, or £13 for a signed paperback. So if you'd like a copy of that, please do just email me and I will sort something out for you. That's great. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for donating. Thank you very much for all the support. Genuinely, it means the world. And I will see you all in about 10 days' time. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.